first of all, thank you for coming. Comic-Con 5-0, here we go. So, some of you may remember this. The original broadcast was in color. This started the comics revolution.
Thousands upon thousands of kids are still buying, seeing millions upon millions of comic books. And a new set of fear and fearsome characters watch daily across the nation's newsstand. But the sound of our kids and spirit only, the old favorites are still the best. The Charles Perrault Reports.
You know how bookshops are. They are quiet, dignified places. The Cherokee Bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard is no different. The loudest sound tends to be a browser clearing his throat. But if you go up the stairs and around the corner to a room in the back, you find an entirely different atmosphere. Here, the ruthless warmongers of Europe are focusing on a peace-loving America and facing Captain America. Here, the ghastly, grim gesture known as the Joker does battle with Batman and Robin, the Boy Wonder. And here, Superman incessantly fights the forces of evil and injustice. And naturally, with all that struggle going on, the sound level in this room is nearly deafening. Bomb, quack, splash, help, whoosh, crash, blam, zip, the top, thunk, thud, thump, thump, zip, crack, pop, pop, bam, bam, ba-loom. The glorious racket of the comic books. Kids always loved comics for their vividness and violence. Mothers always hated them for the same reason. The result was that as soon as the kids' backs were turned, the mothers threw them out. Only a few comic books of the 30s and 40s survived. Enter Rick Bloom, the comic book king of Hollywood Boulevard, who knows a priceless American artifact when he sees one.
This dad and twins are pretty good shape. You know, they're just in the snow. I had a fight on that. That's a good one. And 17 should be a lot more. But I'm going to get 5 is awesome. That's a good one. Okay, I'm going to call this. Also, the Happy Will Science. Before, between about 71 and 83, about 3 years.
How many comic books do you have in this incredible place?
I really don't know. I estimate probably between 100 and 150,000.
Truly, and it's perfectly astonishing. It does take you back, doesn't it? Everybody remembers those things. But I gather not everybody saves them.
No. There's about 2,000 hardcore collectors that you don't like. Spend a lot of money on it. And like I would say, it was Cornish camp collectors. And there's a lot of other people just maybe get one or two for nostalgia, come in and get somebody a present or something, or just because they remember Superman or Batman or a certain issue, they'll come in to buy it now.
There was a whole world that grew up around the comics, wasn't there?
Right, that's the world of premiums. I had like an old pep hat.
Oh yeah, that was
something here. And a kid would send in like for a button or a hat or a ring.
Yeah.
And he'd get you to make a little box and you'd wait for like a month or two and get it. And one of the most exciting things that ever happened is something mailed to you when you're like 8 years old. It's all pet hat, but it has mystical powers. You put it on and maybe you feel like you're 7 again. It's really a fantastic hat. All the little bottom gear buttons on the bottom and there's all the comic book characters on top. Everybody would like, they had spoons, silver bullets, and all kinds of medals and medallions you could send in for. That was really nice. Well, I remember Big Little Books. They had Flash Gordon and Green Hornet and all different titles on it. And these were sort of a little bit more than the comics because it was like writing on one side of the page and picture on the other.
Not so offensive to mothers.
Not so much figured it like a book. Something you just have a picture up in the corner and you flip it and like,
yeah, I remember that. How much do old comic books sell for these days?
My price range from 10 cents each, for less than they sell for an hour, 12 cents, to all the way to $300 a piece.
$300 for a comic book?
You know, if the Batman one here, it would sell for, the commission would sell for $300. There's only the number of one issues that sell for that much money.
Just imagine paying $300 for a comic book that used to seem expensive at a dime. But think about it. Have you ever felt quite so powerful with on the day when you first tied one of your mother's bath towels around your neck as a cape and leapt off the back porch to do battle with evil? Breathes there a man with soul so dead that never to himself has said, Shazam?
So
well, some people never get over it, that's all. Charles Perrault, CBS News, on the planet Krypton.
A heavy gold in our closets. And that's the way it is. Friday, April 24th, 1970.
Thanks again. Hi, I'm Greg Kudulian. My first Comic-Con was 1972, where immediately the late Sheldorf, Richard Alf, Ken Kruger, Mike Tari, Will Lund, Barry all became really good friends. I've been to almost every Comic-Con since 72. I contributed projectors in films in the 70s, and I brought the first video camera in 78. And then I created the first Comic-Con in LA in 73, which was a monthly con. And Terry Stroud, we competed. He started Super Sunday, which was the third one, and we had a mean and friendly competition in the 70s.
But my first Comic-Con was went in 1968. Oh, wait a minute. That was the World Science Fiction Convention.
Yeah. Terry's been around forever. Now, to continue, it's a long story, but I'm the recipient of the Sheldorf Archives. The family gave me 9,000 negatives and transparencies, and for all your young people, he was doing selfies with celebrities and comics creators in the early 1950s with his brother. That's going to be my documentary, Plantidelo Cortez, A Legacy in Time, which I've been working on my whole life. So I've been securing videos like this for years and securing intellectual property so it can be produced and everybody can see it. So let me introduce the panel. Here we got Steve Jeppy, Diamond Comics, the comic book man, baseball man, part owner of the Baltimore Orioles. He's been my friend since the 1970s. Steve Jeppy and Sheldorf told me in the 70s, just wait and see. 10, 20 years, 30 years in the future, comic books, sci-fi, and superheroes will take over all media. Steve used to run around in the dealer's room in his U.S. Postal Service uniform, cosplaying back then. Then we have Steve's son, Josh, head of Diamond Galleries, and then Comic Wow just became Sapphire Studios. And when we talk about comic historians, these guys are some of the best on the planet. Then we got my friend Elliot S. Megan. If you remember, in the 70s and 80s, he was the most popular Superman comics writer in the world. Plus, he helped advocate and promote Siegel and Schuster getting their pension. He wrote an article in Village Voice then. He couldn't find it. I found it. We put it on Facebook. He also helped train Mario Puzo on the Superman screenplay. And he wrote the two books for the movie Miracle Monday and Last Son of Krypton. You mean that?
Yeah.
There you go. Then Alonzo Nunez from Little Fish Comic Book Studios. It's a studio to teach little kids to become comic book creators. He's also the graduate the Visual School Arts. Then we have Matt Dunford, chair of Comics Fest, a local San Diego Comic Con, and he's also the president of Little Fish. And then we have a special guest, Bill Morrison, the former chief of Mad Magazine.
Thank you.
And his career, everybody knows. There's not really much I can add. Then, in the early 1970s, I would go to Michael Rohrer's home in La Mirada to have these film parties. We'd bring projectors, films. That's where I met a lot of creators like Russ Manning. We'd watch Star Trek episodes, and he'd recite the dialogue before Captain Kirk would say it. We were freaked out. He had it all memorized.
And they were 16-millimeter film prints, too.
Right. Wow. And not but least, we got Terry Stroud, the last man standing, the only person to be a dealer at every single Comic-Con. Last year and this year, though, he had to share a booth. And that's the lineup. And basically, we got nearly 50 years of this. What's going to happen in the future in the industry and comic conventions? Because let's face it, I think it's pretty much factual that the San Diego Comic-Con promoted the comics industry better than anything else, maybe even saved it. So, Steve, what do you think? Am I onto something? What do you think?
Did you ask me? What did you ask?
Yeah.
Is he onto something?
I was saying that the Comic-Con probably promoted the comics industry better than anything else, and maybe even saved it.
Well,
it's history.
I'm happy to say the comic industry is alive and well.
Yeah, it should be working.
Is that loud?
That's better. No, I'm hearing no. Because I hear your voice really loud. I'm not hearing my voice at all.
Okay.
Whatever. Can you hear me?
No.
No.
Nope.
Technical difficulties.
How many
pencils? You must.
Okay. Definitely can hear that.
You must learn to project from your diagram.
Right, it's a very large diagram. Anyway, as Greg mentioned, I got this way back when, not quite as far back as guys like Terry, but I was really fortunate to trip over this as nostalgia. I wasn't interested in being in the business with it. But as it turned out, that's where it ended up. But I'm happy to say that here we are, 50 years in the San Diego Comic-Con, and I've been in the business 47 years now, that the industry is alive and well. I think you already know that. Not just because when you walk out here and you see whatever, how many hundred thousand people counting outside and inside is, because the movies have really impacted us. In fact, I should say reverse, we've really impacted the movies, because if it weren't for comic movies, I think right now the movie industry would be pretty dead.
Right.
So the advent of everyone wanting home entertainment, they do everything for you now. They want you to go out for food and do anything. Everything comes to your house. So that's a challenge. But this little thing that we have called a four-color comic book has been a medium that has been underestimated for many, many years. In fact, it was put in a bad position, as you all know, in the 50s, when during the McCarthyism era, everything was bad. Elvis was bad, everybody thought you were a communist, and the comics were bad, and the problem was everybody else kind of lifted that stigma except us. And in the 47 years I've been in it, I've been trying really hard to do my part, along with everyone else, to try to raise our profile. And I'm happy to say that it is larger than it's ever been today. People now, instead of a movie actor saying, I played Daredevil, and covers his face, now they brag about it. They're in all the shows. They're proud of it. And the truth of the matter is they were always secret collectors. They always loved it, but it was wrong or socially incorrect to say you were a comic book collector. And it isn't just limited to comic books. It's actually all about pop culture. So we're in a great position right now. I'm thrilled that Greg asked us to be on here. It's fun to see people who are equally as enthused. And I just think that the future is really, really bright. And you're lucky. You might not think if some of you are new to it or you're not getting in on the ground floor, don't kid yourself. There's a new ground floor being established, and I think you're going to be proud you're here.
Thanks, that's great. Alonso?
It's working.
Yeah, okay, great. So I run a studio here in San Diego, and one of the things that I really see that I think is really cool is, you know, as a fan of comics growing up, you kind of learn about the Golden Age, Silver Age, right, the Bronze Age. And one of the periods that's really kind of fascinating to me running the studio is the kind of 1950s when there was a lull in superhero comics, right? And you had kind of a diverse range of genres, right? You had kind of historical biographies, you had westerns, you had war comics, you had Kirby inventing romance comics, right? And I feel like now, like I've got a studio where primarily I've got female students, you know, for the really, I think for the first time in comics history, right? There's a lot of the confluence of influences for that. I think a big part is Raymond Tegelmeyer and the influence she's had on the comic industry. But you've got, again, that opening of genres, which I think is really cool for the industry. I think superheroes will always be alive and well, but it's really cool to see all these other romances, young adult biographies, westerns come back, all these other things kind of reopen, so kind of dovetail. I think, like Steve was saying, it's a kind of a new ground floor for the comic industry where there's new rules, right? We can kind of reinvent things. There's no golden age, I think. I don't mean like the golden age, but the 1930s, 40s. There's no like perfect era to return to. I think we're building a new kind of perfect era for comics, and I'm super excited about it.
You know, I want to say that I like the idea of the new, because that's what got me involved in comic books in the first place. It was getting boxes of comic books in the early 70s, going through them and pulling out all these outrageous comics that no one knew existed, because there wasn't a single person that knew all the comic books that were out there then. and you'd be getting these outrageous comics, but you'd be going, look at this fantastic cover, or like a run of Laugh comics, an Archie comic, and every other issue for a period of about 4 years was some kind of sexual innuendo on the cover, and you're just like being bowled over by all these outrageous things. Now, if you could apply that to what's going on to now in the movie and television media, and I really don't know how you exactly do that, but I do like that sentiment, that idea that it is possible to get in on the ground floor of something and have all that kind of excitement like I had when you've just seen all these things for the first time.
One thing about Terry Stroud, he's been self-employed selling comics his entire life since he was 12, even on the streets of Hollywood Boulevard.
I never even had a paper route.
Tell that story about collectors, about the kid that had the comic that rolled up in the pocket. That's it.
Yeah, there's this comic shop. It was real kind of a fancy one called Collector's Bookstore, and they had this little shop off of Hollywood Boulevard. And I'd go and kind of hang out there in a Collector's Bookstore, and I saw someone that was, you know, interested in comic books. You know, I might have a few in my briefcase and say, hey, you know, you want to look at some comics, kid? But, of course, I was a kid, too. I was like 15 years old myself. So one day I was walking up to collectors to do some business, and this kid was walking by, and he had this really nice copy of Adventure 48, the first Hour Man, a really hard to get book, and just rolled up kind of in his pocket, you know, but I could see it was really excellent condition, so I asked him about it. He goes, well, I'm going to go sell this to Leonard here at Collectors for $15, and I said to him, well, look, you know, what if I just buy it from you for $15, save you the walk? So while I'm doing this transaction, unknown to me, Leonard is looking down from his office window, and my friend behind me, who's like my backup guy, is laughing and pointing to the comic book so Leonard can see him pointing, going, ha, 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 look what we're doing, but wordlessly. So I didn't know what was happening. And then when I got in to do my business at Collectors Bookstore, I was immediately 86, and it was like another 8 years or 10 years before I could actually establish a relationship with them again.
Mike?
Somebody told me something interesting this weekend, and I just love to repeat it, that Forrest J. Ackerman and I were the midwives to Comic-Con, because we were in the one-day thing in the basement of the hotel in San Diego, and Shell and Company wanted to see if it would be viable to have a convention. And I guess I was I was new into comic books, and I was one guy that I'd met Shell, and so it seemed reasonable to them that I should be their comic book guest. And I'm grateful for that, because I met people that I met privately, and here meeting them in these conventions. You got to know what it's like to be a young guy in their 20s and call up Ray Bradbury and have him invite you over to the house and spend the whole day there. And everybody knows that if you wanted to go to Forrest's house, all you had to do was call and ask him. And I was very lucky to be in on that very first birthing of Comic-Con. And if you want my opinion of what comic books might be in the future, I think it might be a very exciting time, because when you talk about movies and television alone, there are at least 500 scripted television shows in production. So you might find yourself in a market in comic books that you are a niche market. But if you produce something that people want to read and look at and admire, you will find them. And one day we may have, well, already we have so many comic books that I don't know what's all is being published. But I think there could be a very bright future to comics. But what I would like to see, and this is just a dinosaur speaking now, because I still miss the smell of a comic book, the pulp page. Let's just pick it up.
Thanks, Mike.
But I think that I would like to see better stories. In the 80s, I turned away from comic books because it was nothing but big guns and phallic symbols and over dramatized breasts. And I don't see that anymore. But in many cases, I, as someone who's interested in particular characters, I'll pick up a book and look at it. And 20 pages later, it was like the 4-minute teaser before the titles on a TV show. I don't see myself the stories that would make me want to read comic books again more extensively. So I think if you get more people interested in writing about people, characters, and situations that we care about, and that will take us away from mundane real life, I think the future of comics could really be terrific.
All right, thanks.
Or I need therapy.
Something I want to add to Michael's wisdom. A few years ago at Comics Fest, I introduced these publishers of new comic, brilliant artists from England or something. And Michael looked at it, and they were in shock. He goes, this art is fantastic, but it's, everything is too dark. How's anyone going to see it? And that two publishers there were totally in shock. Something so simple they, you know, totally neglected. Now we got Josh Jeffy. Let me guess now something. Have you been in the comics industry your entire life?
Yeah, you can say that. yeah, thanks to this guy over here, I've been literally my entire life has been surrounded by comics. And I think we live in a really exciting time right now because there's not a weekend that goes by you can't find a comic convention somewhere. This thing has grown by leaps and bounds. I've come to Comic-Con, I think, consistently in San Diego since, I want to say, 2002. It was like the first time I had come here after years. I've come when I was a kid to Tampa, but like in Florida, I've been here since about 2002. And it still keeps growing. It's amazing to see where we're at in this industry. I think we always talk about a clubhouse mentality that comics is, and you get somebody that third place, you know, your home, your work, and somewhere to go, hang out with your friends, and you know, kind of come together. I think we all have a responsibility at this point, especially the people who've been in this for a while, to pass that on to the next generation, because it's our job to kind of cultivate these new readers and show them how wonderful comics are, and it's kind of like being reached common ground. I'm really excited about the future of comics because I think, like you said, it's very bright right now. There's so many different things, there's so much that's working, and breaking down, like, you know, walls between things. There's a lot of diversity things going on. There's untouched territories. But it is very exciting. I think we can only grow on that at this point. But like I said, I love this convention because there's, other than there being too many people for me because I have anxiety walking through these crowds. And you'll see me ducking somewhere and like hide because I'm like, I can't take that. But it's just exciting to see this every single year just grow and grow and grow. And that's pretty much it for me. I mean, it's just, I think it's going to only get better.
Thanks, Josh. And now we've got Bill Morrison. And Bill worked for DC Mad. Mike, you worked for DC, and you worked for DC, correct?
I did. Sort of.
Go, Bill.
Well, my tenure at DC was... Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Was fairly short. I was the executive editor of Mad Magazine for the first 7 issues of the new relaunch. And it was great. It was very different from my experience at Bongo. Bongo was kind of like a very small family business owned by Matt Groening. And, you know, I've been working with Matt for years. And it was, you know, just very casual, not what you would call business-like or corporate at all. You know, DC was totally the opposite. It was a big corporation and Warner Brothers above that, so a lot of what everybody at DC did was dictated from up above. I sat in on a lot of meetings that had nothing to do with MAD, but I had to be in the meetings anyway. But it was great being on the inside of one of the giants of the industry and just seeing, you know, what goes into making those characters live and breathe on the page. I'd kind of like to go back a little bit to the first question. When Bongo started, it was 1993. That was, we didn't even have a booth. We all came down to Comic-Con. And we had promotional material, and we just went and handed it out to people. We didn't have like a, we did a signing, but we didn't really have a home base. And then the following year, 1994, we had a proper booth. And it was the year that everybody, like the whole tone of the convention was doom and gloom. There was the speculator boom, and there were all these enhanced covers, and everybody was buying up comics like crazy. Multiple copies, and then so here we are, we're like our first year out and we're all excited to be part of this great industry that we love growing up, and everything that we're hearing from everyone is, oh, this might be the end of comics, and you know, it looks like comics are going down the toilet. And I was standing in the bongo booth, just kind of standing on the perimeter, and Will Eisner walked by. And I had met him, I think, once before at the Eisner Awards, just to say, you know, shake his hand and say hi. And so he really didn't know me, but I said hi to him, and he came over and started talking to me. And he spoke to me like we were old friends. You know, he treated me like an equal. He kind of recognized that I was, you know, part of this publishing company, even though it was small. And I mentioned the fact that, you know, we're just getting started in this business as a company, and it looks like it may not last very much longer because everybody's talking about how it's the end of comics. And Will said, well, you know, I've been in this industry long enough that I've seen this happen four or five times. And he said, every time, everybody's talking doom and gloom, and it looks like the industry's going down the toilet. This might be the last year. And then it bounces back, and something new happens, and it gets reinvigorated. So he said, don't worry. He said, just stick around. There's going to be an upturn, and it's going to be great. And now, all these years later, here in 2019, I never would have dreamed. I mean, Will was so right, of course. But I never would have dreamed that it would be what it is today, you know, and the comic conventions would be what they are today.
Exactly. I did not know I was going to do a monthly con. At the 73 Comic-Con, Phil says, you and your comic book partner, you found a place? Well, we're getting close, because back then you couldn't use your credit card to rent a meeting space. You had to use cash or check. So we're saving our money. And he says, hurry up. You know, Terry Stroud and David T. Alexander in 73, just earlier, a few months, just formed the American Comic Book Company. And that scared the shit out of all of us. So Shell says, hurry up. So November 3rd, 73, at the first one of Kirk Allen as our major guest. And then on the second Sunday at the Universal Sheraton, David and Terry did Super Sunday. And Bill Stout and Scott Shaw did the flyer. It was great. And guess who their fan guest of honor was? The late Shell Dorff. So Shell would push this kind of friendly competition, and then he wanted us to be first, but then he's the guest of honor. And at my monthly con, we about 7 or 8, Shell would help run the projectors. And now we have Matt Lawrence of San Diego. And how old were you at your first Comic Con?
Matt Dunford. But I was 8 years old at my first San Diego Comic Con, and that was all the way back to 1994. And it was the best day of my life. When I went that morning, I saw a commercial for Comic-Con on TV. I said, hey, Dad, can we go? Oh, he said, sure. We go down there, we park, and we get these cool Simpsons bags that have these, like, Simpsons cover on the cover. And Bill Morrison drew that Simpsons cover for the 1994 one. And so this is kind of a trip being up here. And I was absolutely inspired by what I saw. There was so much overstimulation, so many toys and comics and everything. It's like everything I loved in the world was in one collective place. And I just needed more and more and more. I have never been so inspired in my entire life. It's like, oh my God, they're making a Spider-Man cartoon now. Oh my God, there's Pogs over there. Remember Pogs?
I remember Pogs.
Remember Alf when he was back in Pog form?
I don't remember Alf. I think I still have a Casper Pog, but that's about it.
But now here we are, a quarter of a century later, and I've attended every single San Diego Comic-Con, and the thing about my life is, because of that one moment, I just can't tear myself away from comics. It's just, as you might know, I show up to everything. I love going to comic conventions. I love meeting people who make comics and reading their comics. And for me, it's just one of those things where I just want to see comics thrive. I want to share my passion with people. I just want to talk about comics with others. And seeing it grow over the years has been a great thing, too. And some people say, oh, it's too big. It's like, no, it's still wonderful. It gets better and better every single time with the San Diego Comic-Con. I will go so far as to say that this is the most well-run comic convention on the planet. And I just have nothing but love for it. And the thing that I love most about it is, well, like I said, I want to talk comics, and I want to share it with the community. And I love to see that the community has reached out and stretched beyond it. We're seeing local hotels, you know, spill over with Comic-Con. We're seeing all the businesses welcoming comic convention attendees with open arms. We're seeing it even into Petco Park. I love the fact that it takes over this entire town, and the entire world is fixated on us. But then when Monday comes, the world acts like, oh, well, that's comics. I was like, no, but I want to keep comics alive, not only in San Diego, but all across the world, as much as I can, and show that Even though San Diego Comic-Con might be over, it is still alive and well with us because I never stop loving it.
Great. On this panel, there's over 500 years of expert wisdom and experience. And I've known Terry and Mike and Steve since the early 70s. Josh for a few years, Alonzo for a few years, and these two gentlemen for years, and you for a few years. How in the hell did you get hired by DC? And,
oh, for heaven's
sake. Your involvement with the Superman movie, the best one.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a term paper, and I got a B+. And Wikipedia says it was a B-, but it was a B+. But I thought it deserved an A. I went to the professor and told him so, and he said, no, you get a B+. And I sent part of it was a comic book script, so I sent it to Carmine Infantino, and Carmine gave it to Julie Schwartz, and Julie gave it to Neil Adams, and Neil read it over in the subway and came back the next morning and said, if you buy it, I'll draw it. So we did. That was good for 30 years of writing comics and 15 years of writing Superman. What this makes me think of, though, is, you know how psychologists say dreams are like dress rehearsals? They're the rehearsals for things that might happen. I always said Superman stories are, the premise of them is, what would you do in a given situation if you got all the power in the world? They're not about power, they're about choices. Well, we've got recombinant DNA, and we've got manipulation of stem cells, and we've got all kinds of stuff that we don't know what to do with yet, but we know it's going to turn into something enormous. We're on the edge of a rebirth on this planet, and you and I and everybody here has been driving that rebirth because we've been shoveling our imaginations into other people's imaginations. And it's like a collective consciousness we've been making. I got a friend who wrote Superman for about a year, and wonderful Superman stories, and couldn't stand it, hated it. And his editor kept saying, no, you're the lead writer, we want you to write the lead character. And he finally said, I don't want to write Superman anymore, I want to write Batman for the rest of my life. So he did. And they got this young punk to write it instead. I was 20 years old. And I've always told him, my friend Danny, that Superman is a much more realistic character than Batman. We got 500-600 billionaires in this country. Not a damn one of those losers has become Batman. But somewhere out there is the possibility of everything. And we're learning more about spare parts every day. I gotta have a knee replaced in a few months. And I told my orthopedist, I said, as long as you keep making new stuff, I'm good forever. That's what's going on with the rest of us. Everybody thinks the world's ending. My son is convinced, my son's a doctor. He thinks he knows something. He's convinced the world is coming to an end. He's an expert in disaster medicine. And that's, he's gonna save the world. I raised a superhero. I did. Two of them, actually. But he has no idea what's in store for him. I do. I don't know which possible future it is we're heading toward, but I can come up with a dozen really amazing possible futures, and none of them involve the world ending. Because we feed our imagination into people through this medium. And you're the guys that spread it. So that's what I have to say about fandom.
I was going to do a violent argument at a dinner party over whether the average person knew more about comic books or knew more about food. And then the upshot was at the time, this was a while ago, but it was that, everybody has to eat, so that's probably the average person knows more about food. But now, what we call this highfalutin talk, that's almost like, you could make that argument more for the comic books being a little bit more influential these days.
Great. Yeah. Basically a comic book is a movie storyboard, and all the great movie storyboard artists, Bill Stout, Paul Power, they all started in comics. Now the next generation are our youngest people here. We got Matt, Josh, and Alonso. Now, that's why we call it the next generation.
What about me?
Well, I forgot. I totally forgot.
Just because you don't age.
So, Steve, from your perspective and how you started, and oh,
by the way, I almost forgot.
Elliot S. Magan invented LexCorp when you watched the Supergirl series. Don't forget that. So, Steve, when you started out really young at the first Comic Cons early, and then you got your bookstores and stuff, and how you got in distribution and helped change the world, and you know, I know you're really humble, but you know, you'll give credit to others saving the industry, but you're one of the key people in the 90s, you know, when they had a big mess.
Very kind of you to say I've been lucky, I know that. I want to say a few things about the comedy. Earlier, I think it was said, like I said, this, you know, when Will Eisner spoke about having seen the death knell of comics, I remember Paul Levitz used to say he couldn't count how many times there was a predictable date, supposedly, the comics were to go away, so to speak. There was distribution issues, there was all kinds of, in the 50s we had, you know, political issues as it related to it, but I like to think the great thing about comics and why it survived is because comics have partnered with every new innovation. You know, there was television was going to replace radio, and this was going to replace television. Along the way, everything was going to be replaced by something else. But what the beauty of comics was, comics always finds a way to take the newest invention or the newest device and partner with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things I really like to say about the medium itself, we've been the Rodney Dangerfield of entertainment for a while. We didn't get any respect.
Yeah, yeah.
And the movies was always the big deal, and whatever other forms of entertainment. But the reason I think comics are really, really special, and I want you to kind of think about this yourself, you are involved. Now, let me explain what I mean by involved. We can go and see the most incredible special effects ever done. I mean, things we couldn't even imagine they're done. You know, Spider-Man slinging through all that. But the beauty of a comic book, let's oversimplify, you're reading this comic book. We each got the same comic book in our room right now. And we're going left panel, right panel, left panel, right panel. But the beauty of what's happening there as opposed to a movie, it's being interpreted individually by your brain differently than someone else's. So those things that happen between the panels happen in the greatest invention ever that could do better science fiction, or I should say special effects, than anything could ever do, and that's your brain. So when you're reading, maybe Archie's voice sounds one way to you, or Jughead sounds, and to us, that's the only way it sounds, because that's how we hear it in our minds. So I think, as a medium, I don't know of anything else that really does that, because when you go into a movie, it's kind of done for you. You know, you're waiting for it to happen, you're going to all repeat the same thing when you come out. But when you're reading a comic book, boy, that magic that happens between one panel and the other is so unique that I think that it's a shame that the rest of the world took so long to figure out what we knew all along. So we're kind of special in that way, but we're not greedy. We want to share that with everybody. And every year I watched from the first time I got into this and even before me, going back to the 50s when everything was, I said earlier, negative, all the stereotypes. They just didn't quite understand this little jewel called sequential art. Will Eisner knew it in 1939 and 1940. He was the only guy that was really smart enough to protect his rights, per se, because he knew he had something special. He's the godfather, or the founding father of the graphic novel. This sequential art story is great because you, each one of you, are a part of that story in a different way. You're reading it and hearing voices that are different than the other person next to you is hearing. You're seeing things differently. You're interpreting them differently. You, in effect, get a unique experience that I think is only found in comic books.
Great. Wow. Are you on the road a lot? Don't you attend a lot of conventions each year?
Well, I travel pretty frequently just for work in general and then go to conventions, but yeah, I'm pretty much around.
What does that do to your perspective and, you know, what you predict? And, you know, how do you learn from that?
I mean, basically, wherever I'm traveling to, you see kind of the same kind of mentality. It's not like there's anything real different from city to city, state to state, whatever it is. I mean, we all know what's going on, like Comic-Cons, people, how they consume and everything. We see what the shifts are. Like, oh, one of the things I'll say is everybody thought digital was going to overtake what we have in the print medium. The difference is, and I always say with that, is that you're never going to go, like most of us, when we get a comic or whatever, we're going to go to our favorite artist or favorite writer or whatever and get, you know, get it signed or meet them.
and all that, you're not going to go up to them and have your iPad in your hand and say, can you sign this for me? I mean, and there's probably no bigger payoff for an artist, writer, whatever, than seeing your vision in print, you know? But you can see these people at these different conventions they go to, and it's like I said, it's just how they're consuming all this stuff, and the more things they put on the market, the more things they're taking in, and it's just really, it's like I said, it's no different from place to place in my vision. It's just, it's what it is.
I want to ask everybody a question here. In the comics industry and comics fandom, and I'm sure everybody here is basically obsessed in helping and mentoring young people, is that correct?
Absolutely.
Whenever they ask.
One thing I'll say, I'll quote from the infamous Mr. Miyagi. He said, no such thing as bad teacher, no such thing as bad student, only bad teacher. So we have a fiduciary responsibility to teach. You know, learning is great. I was, you know, fortunate or unfortunate, if I had to look at it, things turned out. But I had to quit school in the ninth grade, so I never got that formal education, but I have a greater respect for it than anything. But what I've learned one thing is, going to school is one thing, but learning how to learn is even more important. Because when you learn how to learn, you become a really, really good listener. And when you do that, I've never learned anything when my lips were moving, so I'm not learning anything right now. But that said, I think that Josh touched on a minute ago about the basically how the world was saying the sky is falling. This was another incarnation of what I said before about comics partnering with everything. So along comes digital. And as Diamond Comic Distributors, I got to tell you, a lot of people in my company were panicking. The chicken little, the sky is falling. And I can honestly take a little bit of credit for what I said at the time, for what it's worth. I said, this is not a bad thing. This is actually a good thing. Tied to what Josh says about people inside your eyes, we have collectability. Not that that's the end-all, do-all of it, but it's kind of what got this going. And when you take into account that people love this stuff, they read it, they cherish it. When they started talking about digital, I said, you know, when I was in the store in the 70s, somebody said, why doesn't Marvel and DC run TV commercials? And I'm like, hello, do you know what that costs? And this is these 25-cent comics. But the beauty of the internet is, in a sense, you can proselytize to millions of people for effectively free. So what I thought was that when digital came along, it would only augment comics, and I think that's been proven true. It would get new people who maybe wouldn't otherwise be exposed to comics to see them. My son Steve's sitting there right there now, he's gonna be 18, but when he was young and sitting there and discovering comic books on a game or something online, characters like Iron Man, who was a second tier character in the universe, is now a household word. How did that happen? When I was 5, there was no kinds of entertainment like that, so my mom would go to the store. Keep in mind, back then, I think they said there was like 154,000 different outlets that might have sold comics, grocery stores, drugs. Your mother couldn't find, she tripped over them everywhere. So when she came up with the proverbial rat toy, mommy, what'd you get me? You got a comic book. And you didn't have all this other competition. So a child 5 years old today, he's already on the iPad, he already knows this. Right. So if there was no comic book presence there, goodbye, he doesn't ever become attached. But I always believed in my heart that these same characters, given a chance, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old today will have the exact same embracing of them. And as a result, because of their exposure to things like that, the digital, it's brought in a whole new wave of people. We've got it now where we go to the movies, and maybe these people don't collect runs of titles anymore. They get turned on to the newest characters, the hottest Thanos, or whoever's going on, group, whatever, and they get resurrected, and all of a sudden, you've got a different type of person buying. So in the past, we had, like Josh said earlier, we had you followed the writer, you followed the artist. I wasn't that guy. In the kindergarten, I failed scribbling. I could not draw. So when I opened my comic store, kid came in and said, is that Neil Adams Comics? I said, who's that? I had no clue. Of course, over the years, I learned from listening to them, because when I was a kid, I didn't have any sense of the artist, but I did know when they looked different. Damn it, why does Superman look different this month? It just turned me off. But now I know all that. So you got collectors who collect by artist, by writer, by storylines, and now we got this part of it. People buy the movies, so it's the tail wagging the dog. Originally, when movies were coming out for comics, because they didn't let guys like this get involved in the story writing, you know, that's why the best Superman was.
Everything that they want to take Daredevil was blind and make them deaf instead or whatever. And that wasn't what was pure. So these writers, these great writers that now are involved in this, are the reason why they're so successful. Because there's nothing sells better than a good story. No disrespect to art. I mean, art is wonderful, it's beautiful. But without a good story, it's really hard to sell, just like special effects. You can have all the special effects in the world. Witness what Waterworld at the time, you know, you lose a couple $100 million. But by and large, when you got a good story, look at Carl Barks, the good duck artist. Nobody knew who he was, but somehow, unitedly, everybody around the world said, this is good stuff. Right, and right. I think that's a special part of it. So I want to just tell all of you out there right now, you are so lucky. I'm down the trail a little bit right now. I'm going to be 70 in January. But I hope I still got a lot more to go. But I know I'm living a dream through my son now, and both of my sons, because if they stay interested, I can relive the old stories and tell them about it, and hear them validate it. But also, I'm getting to live some new stories with them, so it's a excellent, great time to excellent. Be in comics.
Great.
All right, thank you very much.
Starting with Mr. Terry Stroud, just real quick, every one of you just will go down the line in like 30 seconds. What the hell was it like at your very first Comic-Con? What kind of experience was that?
Oh, that was kind of interesting. But kind of as a prelude in about the last subject quickly, when I was a kid and I got Fantastic Four number 9, it's when the arch enemy of the Fantastic Four, Vince Namor, hires them as actors to make a movie. And after I read that, I was really excited. I went in to talk to my father. He's lying on the couch reading the paper, and I said, "Daddy-o, daddy-o, do you think they'll ever make a movie about the Fantastic Four?" He looks up from the paper and goes, "Absolutely not."
Mike? Did you only go to a convention after you were professional? Did you ever go as a kid?
I guess technically I became a professional in 1964 or 65. And my first convention was in 1964, World Science Fiction Convention, which I think was in Berkeley or Oakland. And I aspired for a career in comic books. And the artist that I chose to emulate was Russ Manning. And I was a part of Burroughs fandom and knew that he was a member of the Burroughs Bibliophiles, and I automatically assumed that he would be at the Dum Dum at the World Science Fiction Convention. He wasn't, but Camille Castasu, the editor of Urbdom, we met. He saw, I guess, some promise in the crude comic book that another fan and I produced with the permission of Hubert Burroughs on Carson of Venus. And he says, "I'll tell Russ about you because I'm traveling south and I'm going to be visiting Russ." Kaz wrote me and said, you need to contact Russ. I told him about you. So I sent samples to Russ, and it's obvious he was a busy man because I didn't hear from him for 3 months. And he said, "I think if I needed an assistant, you would work out just fine." So I packed up my family, moved to Los Angeles, and bless his heart, when I knocked on his door, he gave me work. He didn't say he needed an assistant. He didn't say he wanted an assistant. But if he needed one, I would work. And he became my first mentor. And I was once at a later comic convention, a weekend thing in Los Angeles, and sat on a panel like this between Russ Manning and Jack Kirby. The two guys that I learned the most about storytelling, the art of storytelling, and putting your reader exactly where you wanted them to go into the next panel. Not that panel followed consecutively, but to put you where he wanted you to be.
Yeah.
And these two masters, and sitting between them, and knowing that in their own unassuming egos, knew that what they were doing was the best way to do it, and in a way they were polar opposites. But I'm sitting here because I was lucky.
Sure.
I was a fan who wanted... I actually had more guts than talent back then.
Bill?
I grew up in the great city of Detroit, Michigan, and my very first comic convention was in 1973, the Detroit Triple Fanfare,
yay,
which was created by Shel Dorff. And I think by that time he was out here in California,
right,
and somebody else was running it.
69.
But it was at the Book Cadillac Hotel. I had like three friends who went with me. One of our parents took us and dropped us off. We got into the convention. My mind was blown because it was not a great big dealer's room, but it was a dealer's room full of old comics, and I was just like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And the first booth I went to, the guy had a copy of Spider-Man number 2. And I guess I was just kind of salivating over it, and I was like, oh my God, look at that. Oh, I wish I had the money for that. Next thing I know, my friends have ditched me. Like, I got lost in a box of comics, and I turn around, and they're gone. I'm like, those guys, doggone it. I can't believe they ditched me. I didn't find them for like 20 minutes. So finally, we hook up again, and we continue with the convention. We call one of our parents to pick us up. A few months later, it's my birthday, and these guys had chipped in all their money and bought me that copy of Spider-Man number 2. It was $30 in 1973.
Yay.
I still have that copy of Spider-Man number 2, of course.
Okay. Like I said, my first comic convention was in 1994 here in San Diego, and it was that overstimulation that just, I wanted to take in every single thing. I wanted to read every single comic inside. I wanted to play with every action figure. I wanted to do that. And over the years, I just became just a voracious reader of comics, reading, well over, I think, 40,000 of them at this point. And now it's put me into a position where I just want to share what I've done. I want to share the stories I've read. I want to help young creators get their comics in the stores. I want to help local comic stores. I've even, gone so far as to become a convention organizer myself. And I use it to help a community because I just want to share it. And I want to help people follow their dreams. And I just want to share what they love. And I love comics. Great. Plain and simple.
Great.
In 1969, I'm going to Hollywood High School. I walked home to Ren Gower or in Sunset on Hollywood Boulevard. I'd go to Cherokee. Nobody told me about Comic-Con. So in 71, right before I graduated from Fairfax High School in West LA, Larry Bigman, who was a popular dealer, now is a retired psychiatrist, told me about the El Cortez. But I didn't go to 72. So my father, mother, and sister dropped me off at 10, went to the beach in San Diego, picked me up at 5. And when I went in there, I was in shock, because I virtually had no friends that were into science fiction or comics. And then they said, you want to see Jack Kirby? And I don't know if it was Will Lund or Mike Towery pointed him out to me. And there he is, right out of a 1930s, 40s newsroom. He's got the high-waisted pants and cigar pipe. And I was telling, I think, Mike the other day, Jack Kirby at the old Comic-Cons, you would literally see him either smoking a pipe or cigar with him the same day.
My first Comic-Con was, I think it was a Phil Sewing.
Well, I know.
It was a Phil Sewing convention in New York, 71. Julie Schwartz gave me this card and said, do you want to go to a party? And I said, sure. So he said, take your girlfriend. I didn't have a girlfriend. He says, you'll meet somebody. So I go to this convention. And I sit down at a table, and Phil, who organized the whole thing, was sitting there. And I wanted to introduce myself to him. And he interrupts me and says, I don't know how I got in here, and I don't care. I'm not into morality. Just have a drink. So I did. And then another one. And he ended up making friends with Phil for like 10 minutes. But that was my first comic convention. I don't think I've ever been to one as a kid, other than the fact that I was a kid when I was writing it.
Yours.
See, when was yours?
It was 1976, I want to say. The first Comic-Con. That was the industry before that, but I've never been to Comic-Con.
East Coast or San Diego?
San Diego.
Yeah.
San Diego back in the day, so to speak. And it is to say I was overwhelmed. One of the reasons was because, believe it or not, I was 26. Let's say it was 76, I was 26. I had only flown in an airplane twice prior to that. I was to Florida and back. So going across the country was quite a challenge to get me on that plane. But it was so worth it when I got out here. And thinking back to the first day I opened my store, people started coming in. And everybody who came into my store thought they were the only comic book collector in the world. Because at home they were considered nerds or geeks or whatever. But thinking back to that time, it reminds me of how all of a sudden this clubhouse mentality that was mentioned earlier that is the crux of what we do, I now went to the giant clubhouse.
Right.
The big clubhouse in the sky, so to speak, but now it's like a pipsqueak compared to what it is today. But that feeling of being surrounded by people who all thought you were as normal or as crazy, depending on how you look at it, as they were, was such a great feeling. And I haven't lost that feeling, and I love that I'm passing on to my kids, and they're enjoying it like I am.
Cool. Josh?
I don't remember exactly when it was, what the date was, but first Comic-Con that I went to, going in there, it's like the same thing we said before, it was like sensory overload when you're a child and you see all this stuff and you're like, oh my God, you don't know where to look first. Like, this is amazing. I was always more obsessed with artwork than anything. I got these stories later. Like, I was just blown away by all these people, like the Jim Lees and Jack Kirby's and all these people in the world. And that's just basically what it was for me. It just sensory my first Comic-Con was 92, and it's the same thing. It was a, you know, you walk in, it's just this magical place, you know, like, I've come home, you know. Up until that point, I don't think I'd ever been to a comic store even at that point. So, for me, comics was a spinner rack, right, in the corner of like a 7-Eleven or a bookstore. And now I'm lucky enough to be able to teach, hopefully, what is the next generation, if I don't scare them away from comics. And I have with me this Comic-Con 15 students. I haven't lost one yet. Peter, where are you? Okay. There's the missing one. I take it as really my kind of my privilege to be able to share kind of my enjoyment of the comic industry, my love of it, introduce them to professionals that I know, get their first portfolio reviews, and share my love with them, and pass that on to them. It's really, to me, it feels really, really special, and a big part of continuing the legacy of Comic-Con.
Alonso, one question, and we're going to finish with Alonso's last statement, and we'll get out of here. How unique is Little Fish Comic Book Studio? Are there any other places in the country that have a bunch of little kids doing what you're doing?
Little Fish is kind of a hybrid in that we teach classes, we teach camps. We're not meant to be a college. We don't charge $20,000 a year, but we're not also kind of just a hobby group where you show up and here, kids, here's some markers, draw whatever you want. You know, it's supposed to be, I got my degree in comic book art from the School of Visual Arts in New York City. Teachers like David Mazzucchelli, Klaus Janson, these guys, and they really taught me, the kind of foundational principles of comics, and that those can be shared even with kids as young as 6, 7, 8, and they can be taught the vocabulary and grammar of comics, apply it to whatever it is they're doing. But then we also do a lot of advocacy for comics itself. Who here is local to San Diego? Awesome. I don't know if you guys know, and especially out of towners, but the book of San Diego right now, as chosen by KPBS, part myself, the book of San Diego right now is a comic book, it's a graphic novel. It's March book one.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
All right,
thank you so much.